Will you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, dearest Master, blessed Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart my thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Ooh. Reading from Papa Ram Dass, God Experience, Volume 2. When Universal Power Works in You. Devotee's question. I feel that when I forget God and my spiritual aims completely, then I do nothing, and everything that I do or speak happens very mechanically, without any feeling. On the contrary, when I remember God, I have some inner attention awakened, and then only I have the feeling that I do or speak. I do not know if I have made myself clear. Papa. Where is there the question of I, then? In the remembrance of God, you lose the I, and still actions take place. In remembrance of God, you are lost. If you truly remember Him, even if you pray to Him, you feel so humble, you eventually lose your I-ness, and still actions are going on. If you search who is the doer, you do not find Him. The universal power is active in you. In the remembrance of God, the ego sense either becomes very low or completely disappears. Ecstasy is felt in that state in which I-ness does not exist. Still, you are active. Ram Dass was feeling once, many years ago, when he was walking in the streets, that his body was moving and he was static. He felt he was pervading everywhere and was the changeless, motionless spirit, and the body was moving. Ram Dass was feeling once, many years ago, when he was walking in the streets, that his body was moving and he was static. He felt he was pervading everywhere and was the changeless, motionless spirit, and that the body was moving. He was wondering how this was possible while he was in the static spirit, all-pervading, nameless, and formless. This was a strange experience, but now he is fully conscious that he is activated by the universal power, not by the ego sense. At the same time, there is the awareness that he is the all-pervading Brahman, the all-witnessing truth. Therefore, he is full of bliss. Before this experience, he thought through ignorance that he was doing everything as an individual, and he was not happy. The sense of doership or I-ness was there. Now it is not. The divine is doing everything in and through him. He sees it so with everybody in the world. Actually, it is the divine working through every one of us. When the ego is there, naturally the I-ness is there. You will find then your actions are uncertain and irregular. Uncertain in the sense that you are not sure you have done the right thing. You judge your own actions and find some of them to be good and some bad. This is the work of the ego. In the other case, you never walk in the path of unrighteousness or falsehood, because selfishness is not there. Whatever is done without selfishness is right. If the ego is there, you are very much doubtful about yourself and your actions. Reason comes to tell us whether we are right or wrong. Even reason is not the criterion. And when he works in you, you are never in the wrong. So, you are asked to surrender your ego sense and put yourself entirely in his hands so that he can work in and through you. You then become a radiant and flaming instrument of God. You radiate light, peace, and love for all alike without any distinction, because your vision is universal based upon the knowledge of the all-pervading God. Knowledge of God is what is called Brahma-jnana, jnana of the Purusha, jnana of Shiva, this static aspect of the divine. So your struggle is to get rid of the ego sense, get rid of the I-ness, which is the cause of your feeling that you are bound and you are ignorant and thereby restless and unhappy. There's a complete talk right there. And it is absolutely true, of course, what Papa says here, is that the sense of I-ness is what makes all the trouble. And through God remembrance, the mind is purified, and eventually the sense of I-ness completely disappears. That experience that Papa talked about, where he was walking down the street, and he felt that he was the static, formless, beginningless, endless spirit. And at the same time, activities were taking place in the body. The body was moving. The body can speak. Thoughts can flow through the mind. And it is a wonder that both can take place at the same time. You know, in that moment, the superior aspect is the static, beginningless, endless aspect. And that the expression of God through form, through activities, is at one time made up of the very same stuff, but that things do begin, things do end, and that, therefore, it has an inferior aspect to it. Now, this is just a perspective. In another perspective, there is no difference at all. It all feels to be the same. These are very difficult experiences to describe, because they go beyond the mind, they go beyond our ordinary experience. And therefore, we can only try to reach out and grasp the real meaning behind it unless we've had the experience ourselves. To feel that God is doing everything through you and that you are the instrument does produce a state of bliss. Sometimes people are in different states of consciousness, and one state can be where an individual feels very numb to this world, very indifferent to it, but it is a dissociative state. It is not a truly realized state. Because in the realized state, you feel the measureless aspect of God is pervading everything, and therefore you are part of everything. Master once wrote the poem in which he said that he was the grass upon which people walked. He was the trees. He was the sunlight. He was everything that was. And this is the truth, that there is this all-pervading aspect. In Christianity, there is the three Godheads in one. There is one God, but there's three aspects of God. And to some, this can sound like sacrilege, because there is only one God, isn't there? And it is true that there is only one God, and God is one and part of everything, and everything is part of that. But it is also true that we experience this creation. And when you go into this creation, you start to experience the multiplicity of God's power divided up in so many forms, so many activities, And seemingly, many of these actions are in opposition to each other. The truth is, however, there is but one power and one God. And therefore, you have tried to explain it in various ways. Through your activities in this world and what you see, how God is manifesting in this creation, and also what you know of yourself as being one with that supreme Godhood that is beyond all activity, all thought, all creation. So this three-pronged aspect of God the Father, who is that static aspect that is formless, beginningless, endless, and stands apart, so to speak, from creation in terms of the Trinity. And then there is the Divine Mother. Divine Mother, or Mother Nature, goes out and manifests as all creation. It is the same pure God energy, God light, God life, that is in that pure elemental aspect beyond all creation. And yet it is active. Krishna told Arjuna that if at any one point he were to stop acting, this creation would immediately disappear. And therefore he is always in activity. And yet he is also the static, never-changing aspect of spirit. Both are true. And so Divine Mother comes into creation and brings forth all the different elements that we see, all the things of creation. Isn't it magnificent how we can see a flower, how we can see the river flowing, the ocean, the mountains rise up? It's all a remarkable, incredible show, and it is all the Divine Mother manifesting herself as this creation. And it is pure, it is sacred, it is divine. Then when human element enters into it, man is given free will. And through that free will, we are able to go off into our own individual journey in which we can utilize this mind as separate from God. We don't have to enter into that, but so many of us have. And therefore, a veil of ignorance is drawn over that divine consciousness. Now we experience ourselves as just an individual living in this world. It is started at some early aspect of creation. I experienced myself coming into this creation, and my first experience was feeling the flow of lava, of molten rock, and it felt so wonderful. It was just so interesting to come in and this element, this most basic of elements, and to experience myself as creation. And then as you, in consciousness, are drawn to various aspects of this creation, then there is the vegetable kingdom. And there is very limited movement. There is limitations in terms of growth. And yet it is very fascinating. And then you come into the animal, and in the animal you get more movement, and you get more choice. You can begin to choose, I want to graze over here or over there, I want to associate with this pack or not that pack, and so on. And so it becomes a little bit more choice, a little bit more consciousness, and more movement. As you continue to develop, eventually you earn the right to come into human consciousness. You have to earn it because it is something that is more complicated, and it takes you onto a journey further still. And now reason enters in a greater way. And this buddhi aspect, in India, there are the two aspects of mind. The lower mind is manas. Manas, as described by Swami Vishwananda, is essentially any consciousness that a dog can have, a choice that basically is in the here and now, is not abstract thinking, can have some basic reasoning kinds of skills, but there's limited to that. And then you have the higher aspect, which is the buddhi, and the buddhi is the can think abstractly, starts to project into the future, and relates more to the past, Now, there's a great virtue in this because it is a quickening of intelligence in one way, but it's also a devil in another way because it begins to take you further away from the unified God consciousness and seeing everything as spirit. You begin to rely on your reason, and your reason is now your means for survival, but it is also your basic operating system within you. And as you rely more and more on it, you become more encapsulated as an individual. You now abstractly think of yourself as a separate autonomous being. And therefore, it can take you into greater sense of separation. So this is the evolution of man. But a great gift was given into all creation because God, being all-knowing and all-seeing, knew that there would be souls who would choose to go into this field of separation and to become completely ignorant of who and what they really are. And so there was this sun, this Christ intelligence, or Krishna intelligence, the Kutascha Chaitanya, that is spread out through all creation. And it is the firstborn of every creature. It is embedded in every atom, in every element of creation. And this pure Christ consciousness is the purity of the Father and of the Mother that is spread throughout creation. And no matter how far you go into ignorance, no matter how confused you become as to the truth about your being, this Christ intelligence remains untouched, pure, and ever residing within you. It can be in a dormant state for a very long time, just waiting for your intensity of intention and desire and devotion to awaken it. It has been described as the yeast that is inside of the bread. But for yeast to become active, there has to be a certain temperature arrived at. Otherwise, it remains dormant. And the same is the truth of the Christ within you. And that when your devotion, when your desire to know God and to realize God begins to heat up, so to speak, the oven, then the yeast of Christ consciousness within you begins to become activated. Now, you can't fake this. There are people who are part of religious organizations and become known as spiritual teachers and so on, and yet they may not truly have activated this Christ consciousness. It's more of a mental thing. It's a thing of will. And so it can't be faked. It has to be something that has to be for real. And it's not just an idea. It's not just something that you believe in. That when this force within you becomes activated, then it begins to grow inside of you and it gives you experiences. It makes you know the truth of your own being. When I first experienced God, after my middle years in which I grew in ignorance more and more, when I came into this world, I knew much more about God than I did later on. I used to sit in my room and I would hear the Om and it would be so loud it would hurt my head. Yeah, but I didn't know what it was at the time. And I just simply called it the sound of silence because I had no other wording for it. And it was this tremendous Om sound that later on I forgotten about completely, and then gradually I began to hear it again as I deepened my meditation. And that there were times when I felt God's mind upon me easily in my earlier years, and then in my middle years, I completely gained an ignorance of that as well. And this happens for many, many people because when we enter into our teen years, there's oftentimes a time of associating your consciousness with this world. You become more interested in this world. You become more social being. You are attuned to many things in this way. And it draws your mind out. And where before, perhaps through your first 10 years or 12 years or so, you had this natural kind of awakening. And you're awake to spirit in a way that later on your reasoning mind and your desire nature begins to draw you out. Now, it doesn't have to happen this way, because at that age of puberty, you also get this sexual energy activated, but it doesn't have to be turned outward. That's so much of what begins to draw your mind out into this world. It also has the capacity for lifting you up, for becoming this kundalini energy, and that's why Jesus, at the age of 12, was found teaching in the temple. And he was awakening even greater, because even though he came in as a perfect avatar, a perfect, perfected soul, still he had to go through these developmental stages. And so he came into this time when he was teaching the elders, and they were amazed at what he knew and how he taught. There's a complete difference between one who teaches from rote, one who has studied many books and talks about things. Perhaps they're a very interesting person to listen to. But they've not yet discovered that Christ within them, and therefore there's ignorance embedded in what they're saying. And they cannot lead another individual into their own perfection, because that teacher, that one, has not yet developed themselves to that point. And so we have to be careful what we take into the mind, what we take into the body. It has to be of the purest and the highest, whether it be of food, whether it be of thought, whether it be of association. We should always be careful about what we imbibe into ourselves. When you take in a story, take in stories that are uplifting, edifying, a hero's journey. Make it something that uplifts the soul. Don't make it something that just appeals to the lower nature, because it will have an effect until you have gone the whole way. And even then, when you live in this body, this world has an effect upon you. Mother talked about those who thought that she should be above it all, and that nothing should ever bother her. And she said that's not the case, that she both had the humanness and the divine. Now, of anyone I've ever met in this life, she was the most perfectly balanced of male and female, and she was definitely woman in human form. And she came with many of those attributes, but she also had the male masculine attributes as well. She wasn't mannish in any kind of way, but the sense of will, those things that are associated with prototypically male energy, intelligence and will and reason, she had it in such terrific amounts. And so this is the goal for all of us, is to enter into this realm of perfect balance, where male and female are perfectly balanced in us. Now, one may always hold greater sway over you than the other, and this is natural, but it should also be that we develop fully all of our capacity in God, in the God sense. I've been reading a book lately about Sarada Devi, and she is the wife of Sri Ramakrishna, who was a yogi Christ of his era. And when I was at Balaramut, and there was a temple to the Holy Mother, as they call Sarada Devi. And I didn't have much connection. I could see it was a lovely temple. There were ladies who were sitting there, some of them in meditation, some in devotion. So I could see that people had a draw to her, but I didn't know that much about her life. And I picked up this book from Mother's Library, Sri Sarada Devi, the Holy Mother, put out by the Ramakrishna Mission. They don't say who the author is. And so I thought I would read you a little bit, because it's talking here about the combination of the human and the divine. And they had written about how Sarada Devi was very much had demands put on her by her family. In later years, some of the devotees saw to it that she was taken care of financially. This wasn't the case for the first few years, and she really went through some very difficult times. And then relatives began to see her as somebody who had prosperity, and they would come with certain demands. And there was one niece who was there who was mentally unbalanced, and she just doted upon this niece. Everything seemed like her whole world revolved around her. And so the author was drawing out that even though Sarada Devi had this divine nature to her, she also had this human nature to her. Now, having been with Mother, we're very familiar that the human and the divine coexist within an awakened being. And yet for some people, this can be very confusing. And so they're talking about this, and I thought I would just read from some of this book. There seems to be two phases in the character and activities of such personages, intertwined, no doubt, but sufficiently distinguishable by the stress that one or the other receives according to time and circumstances. On the one side, they look quite human, and their activities resemble those of worldly men. But unaffected by this aspect, there enters in then another strand, so different from anything in the common run of men, carrying with it a sanctifying influence that dissipates the darkness of ignorance from those who come in contact with them. In spite of the apparent conflict between the two phases of life, they coexist in perfect harmony in such great men, adding significance to their lives from the viewpoints of pure spiritual aspirants, as well as those who are in quest of worldly ideals. Such has been the case with some of the great incarnations like Ram, Krishna, mentioned in Hindu scriptures. In the life of the Holy Mother, too, this analysis holds good. In the latter part of her life, as depicted in the Conversations, comprising the second part, she is seen surrounded by distinct types of people, her relatives on the one hand and her disciples on the other. Both these groups approached her with quite different motives, the first to gain whatever material advantages they could from her, and the second to serve her and benefit spiritually by her contact. In the preceding chapter, her dealings with her relatives has been considered, and in the present one, her relation to those who went to her for spiritual illumination will be dealt with. It is, however, pertinent to inquire how she could fulfill both these apparently incongruous duties without detriment to either. Could it be that there were two watertight compartments in her personality so that the spiritual side could remain uncontaminated by worldly dealings? Ultimately, this is a riddle which shades off into the mystery of the deity. The question how he manifests himself in the world and yet retains his pristine purity. From the analytical point of view, which alone ordinary persons are capable of at their level of thought, some sort of compartmental theory is the only understandable course. There are many utterances in the Holy Mother herself which lend support to the application of this theory to her case, for she is known to have made such statements as the following: "The vision of God is in the palm of my hand. I can have it whenever I want. In the midst of worldly activities, wherever I desire, I understand with a flash that all of this is nothing but a play of Mahamaya. Don't regard me as your relative. I can leave this body at once if I so desire. No one will be able to know my real nature as long as I am alive." But in the case of the Holy Mother, however, two different aspects of her mental life may be in their functioning. One finds an underlying unity in their essence, insofar as both of them are expressions of the great principle of motherhood, of which her whole life is a revelation. In our review of her domestic life, we have shown how the impelling force behind even her worldly attachments was her sense of motherhood, a form of love that only gives but never thinks of any return, nay, gives even when any return takes the shape of ingratitude and persecutions, and how for this reason even her worldly love occupied a position in the borderland of pure spirituality. In her role as a spiritual teacher, too, it is the very same principle of motherhood that is illustrated, perhaps through a medium that reveals the true quality of it with greater directness. The Hindu religious ideals, the relation between the disciple and guru, spiritual preceptor, is the most intimate and sacred. The disciple is expected to see in the guru a channel through which divine mercy manifests itself for his redemption, and as such, put implicit faith in his words and obey his commands without questioning. This exalted conception of the guru, entertained by the disciple, makes the work of the former a very responsible one. He must be a man of great spiritual attainments, should know the purport of the scriptures, and must be guided only by love and mercy for suffering humanity in the manner of accepting anyone as a disciple. There must be absolutely no commercial motive. He may, no doubt, accept whatever gifts the disciple offers in love and reverence, but they should never be an incentive to his spiritual ministry. He must be more like a parent, only much nobler than any parent we come across ordinarily in the world, interested mainly in giving to the loved one, not in receiving any corresponding advantage from him. Such being the conception of the guru from the Hindus, there must have been few so qualified as the Holy Mother was for discharging the onerous responsibilities connected with it. By virtue of her long preparation for this work under Sri Ramakrishna, the direct command he had given her to continue his spiritual mission and her great spiritual attainments, she was eminently fitted to play the role of guru. Besides these qualifications, it was her inherent quality of motherhood, which blossomed to its full proportions all about this period, rendering her so selfless, forgiving, kind, and anxious to serve that distinguished her among the great spiritual teachers of the world. The idea will be clear if one remembers her own words on the responsibilities she undertook when she initiated anybody as a disciple. Quote, "The power of the guru is transmitted through the mantra to the disciple," she once said. "That is why the guru, at the time of initiation, takes on himself the sins of the disciples and suffers so much from physical maladies. It is extremely difficult to be a guru, for he has to take the responsibility for his disciples' sins. He is affected by them. A good disciple, however, helps the teacher. Some disciples make quick progress, and some do it slowly. It depends on the tendencies of the mind acquired by one's pure deeds. That is why, recall, Swami Brahmanananda hesitates about giving initiation. He said to me, 'Mother, as soon as I initiate a disciple, I feel physically ill. The very mention of the mantra makes me feel feverish.'" Probably for the above reason, Swami Brahmanananda used to be very sparing in the matter of giving initiation. Hence, the vast majority of devotees who sought initiation were sent to the Holy Mother, for, as far as she was concerned, her motherly love and tenderness for all never allowed any such consideration of personal suffering to stand in the way of giving refuge to those who went to her. Referring to this quality, the Holy Mother, Swami Premananda once said, "We are sending to the Holy Mother the poison we could not ourselves take. She is giving refuge to everybody, accepting the sins of all and digesting the same." It was her conviction that the great physical sufferings that she had to undergo in life due to illness were of the vicarious nature, being the effects of the sins she had taken from her disciples. An unsympathetic critic will, of course, pronounce this statement to be mere rationalization. But there are other incontrovertible facts of her life which show that such powers were present in her. As in the case of the Master, the utter purity of her life, both physical and mental, had endowed her organism with an extreme sensitiveness to anything that was unholy or sinful. Thus, it was noticed that when certain people, evidently with sinful propensities, proceeded to touch her feet, the feet would shrink back, even against her will, as if by reflex action. Often her disciples saw how she suffered from a burning sensation due to the indiscriminate touch of people. In 1916, when she attended the Durga Puja at Blurmut, people without number prostrated themselves before her and touched her feet. A little later, Yogin Ma saw her washing her feet again and again with the Ganges water. She remonstrated with her, saying, "Mother, what is it that you are doing? You will catch cold." To this the Holy Mother replied, "Well, Yogin, how can I explain it to you? Some people touch my feet, and that refreshes me wonderfully. And again, there are others who touch gives me a terrible burning sensation. I feel it like a sting of a wasp. Only by applying the Ganges water do I get some relief." Another disciple records a striking example of this phenomenon at Jayrambat. That's the hometown where she lived. The disciple who was then attending her and had gone out, on returning, he found the mother lying on a straw mat on the veranda. Seeing the disciple, she said to him, "A rather elderly man came here with L. Seeing him from a distance, I entered my room and sat on my bed. He was very anxious to salute me by touching the feet. Though I protested and shrank back, he touched my feet by force, as it were. From that time, I am almost on the point of death through an unbearable pain in the feet and in the stomach. I washed my feet 3 or 4 times. Still, I cannot get rid of the burning sensation. Had you been here, you would have understood it by sign from me and forbidden him to touch my feet." In Calcutta, the disciples noticed such occurrences, especially on certain holidays when general public was allowed to salute her. But when she spoke of her suffering to any, she would add, "But don't tell Sarat, Swami Saradananda. Then he will stop people from coming." So compassionate was she, in spite of her suffering, she still did not like to deprive others of the satisfaction and relief they derived by her contact. So it gives you a little flavor for her life and who she was. It's so wonderful that we have these various aspects of God, and in reading about her life, has put me into further touch with Divine Mother. And Divine Mother is a special relationship in our life. The Father sits back, more so to speak, and observes life from a distance and sees it all from his perch of unified feeling of bliss and love. But the Divine Mother, her heart goes out to all of creation because it is all part and parcel of her. She feels that love. She feels that compassion. She rolls up her sleeves and she gets to work washing her children. And Divine Mother is intimately interested in all aspects. Both Papa and Master were particularly closely associated with Divine Mother. And as Master, as we've heard him say in the recording, that Mother is closer than the Father. And so it is in their view. Each individual has their own connection, has their own relationship with God. And some may feel offended that there should be any personality or any material aspect connected with God. But God, who is the creator of everything that is, why should he not manifest through his forms in all of his purity and all of his perfection? Some would say this is sacrilege, but I do not think so. It has been my own experience that through these imageries and through these various forms and the stories that go along with them, there is a tremendous spirit that travels with them. It is uplifting. It is purifying. And this is an aspect of all divine personages, that there is a purifying and pure aspect to them. When we come into contact with them, we feel touched. And in that touch, we feel that we are washed clean of our sins, those things that keep us separated from God. That you feel lifted up in peace and bliss and joy of God. That you are changed, never to be the same again. This is an absolute criteria for anyone who has realized God. And to the degree that you have realized God, you have that effect on the people who are around you. Somebody may just say, you know, whenever you're around, I just feel such peace. Or I just feel better about myself. And it is, in effect, the purity of God that you feel within yourself is manifesting through you. You become a transmitting station for divine consciousness. Now think about where your mind goes to in relationship to this creation. You have this capacity to be that kind of transmitting station. And yet, as you go about your life, and as you do the ordinary things that you do, is your mind fixated upon God? Do you feel God within you? Do you feel that purity? Do you feel that light? Or do you get caught up in the minutiae of life? Do you get caught up in the little things of life that distract you from that conscious awareness from God? It's very simple, really. It goes right to the heart of where you put your mind and what occupies your mind throughout the day. When you feel God, you feel that ever-new joy. You feel that upliftment. You feel that purity. Without that, you can be thinking of God, but you're not making God contact. We have to break through the barriers of those things that separate us from God. For some people, it is in deep meditation they feel God the greatest, and then they go out into the world and they get sucked into this world and into the world of separation. For other people, meditation is a battleground. But then they go out into the world and they actually experience more God contact by operating in this world than they did in their meditation. And neither one are wrong. They're just works in process. We're a work in process. And sometimes meditation is the great battleground. It's where the ego takes its stand. And it will not brook the light coming in because it recognizes that meditation is the most direct route to God. Others who experience that direct connection in meditation, then their ego really acts up when they go out into this world. And it draws them out into this world, and suddenly they're in a state of separation. We need one whole unified life. Father, Mother, Son, as the Trinity goes, all active, all in place, all manifesting in the heart, in the mind, and the soul of the individual. And when this is in place, you become one whole person. There's this lovely story of the father whose son is kind of tugging at his sleeve while he's reading the paper, and he's thinking, oh, this boy is frustrating me right now because I just want to read the paper. So he takes a page out of the paper that happened to be a map of the world. And he gives it to him, and he tears it up into pieces like a puzzle. And he says, now you just go over there and occupy yourself with putting the world into place and making one whole map out of it, getting all the parts right. And he thinks, well, this is going to take him hours, and I'll be able to peacefully read my newspaper while he's over there trying to figure this out. Well, within not that long a time, the boy comes back and he says, Father, I've done it. And he shows him, and the whole world is all perfectly put together, and he's amazed. He didn't know that his son knew geography that well. And he said, Son, how did you do that? He says, I'm absolutely amazed about this. And the boy flipped the picture over, and on the back side was a picture of a person. And he said, you see this picture? I discovered this picture of the person on the other side. And when I put the person together, which was easy enough, the whole world came together. Isn't that wonderful? When you put the individual together, the world takes shape, it takes form, it's put together correctly. You now see the world not as a manifestation of ignorance and darkness and warfare, which from a human standpoint we can say it is, but now once you put the person together, now you see it as a manifestation of God. And that God is taking care of his creation. God is taking care of his manifestation. And whatever the appearances are, everything is working out to perfection. Now, as Papa said, sometimes the further the world gets away from God, it's absolutely necessary because it gets into such a state of suffering that eventually it cries uncle and it turns finally its attention towards God because it's made such a terrific mess out of everything. It's so painful and difficult, it gives up on the human then and realizes that only God can function as the Savior. This is the case for me when I came into my late teen years and I went through a very painful breakup and a heartbreak, and I just literally felt my heart split in two and just in such pain. And I came to the end of my wits as an individual, as a human, as to what to do. And until then, I'd been a studied agnostic. I didn't know whether God existed, but I certainly didn't feel any connection with him. And so in the extremity of my pain, I prayed to God. I don't know if you exist, but if you do exist, if I've never needed your help before, I need it now. And in that moment, I felt an immediate uplift of the spirit and a taking away of the tremendous burden that I felt was just crushing me at the time. And I knew that something had happened. I couldn't explain it. I didn't necessarily have a name for it, even though I had called upon God. But I didn't know any of that. I just knew that I was relieved of that pain in that moment. And that was really the beginning of my journey in my adult life, back towards God. And it was a slow and uncertain and wending path. But it was the turning point. And it awakened something in me that I could not deny and I could not put away. And so this is where mankind in general comes to, that when his own wit and his own reason has led him into such a terrible state, eventually humanity itself will cry out to God. Now, this isn't the way that we like to see it happen. We like to see people wake up to the fact that God is the answer to the soul's need for lasting happiness, and that it cannot come from this world. And wouldn't it be lovely for people to wake up to that through wisdom rather than having to go through the intermediary of pain? And we will see. We will see what God allows for. And when God is orchestrating everything, then we have that perfect trust. Just recently, as many of you know, Greg Huff went through a terrible accident. He was riding his bicycle. It was dusk. He had put on his sunglasses because they were the only glasses that he had with him to keep the bugs out of his eyes. And because of that and the darkness that was ensuing, he didn't see a large rock that was in his way when he was riding his bicycle, and he hit that. And he must have cartwheeled. He went through a sign and broke through a sign, and then he hit a light post. And he hit it with his back, and it broke 7 of his ribs It dislocated his shoulder and it punctured his lung. He was really in trouble. And it's a difficult thing to go through, but even in that, he kept his wits about him. Somebody saw the accident happen and they pulled over and asked him to call 911 and to call Jill. And they took him immediately to the hospital. And it's been a difficult recovery, but we saw him yesterday and he looked in very good spirits. And he was sitting up and he's expected to go home on Monday. So our prayers have been with him. And a devotee had said that she'd gone in and seen him just briefly previous to our getting there. And she said the room just felt like it was filled with light. Filled with light. And that there have been those who are the caregivers who have remarked how quickly he seems to be recovering. And so what we pray for is speedy and complete and total recovery. And that he have that. Now, it may seem strange to say, but he was slated for something even much worse. The doctor said if it had just been even slightly over, it would have affected his spine and would have broken his spine. And that, of course, would have been much worse than what happened. And so even though that was what was slated for him to happen, that wasn't the case, but still there's a certain amount of it that he had to go through. And so when in this life we experience these things, everything can happen in a flash. You have all of these plans. You think your life is going in a certain direction. All you're thinking about is what you're going to be doing next. And then all of a sudden one occurrence happens and your entire life changes. Peg, who's a Kriyaban up in Canada, her husband was up on a ladder. And just not that tall of a ladder, but it went over. And he broke his leg. And as a result of that, it became infected. And they thought they were going to have to remove his leg because it got gangrene infection in it. Imagine in this day and time that that would occur. And fortunately, they were able to save the leg, but he's never been able to really go back to his profession, which was being a chef, because that requires standing on your leg a lot, and the leg never completely recovered. And so in a flash, everything can change. We think that we're in control of our lives, and in truth, we do make decisions, and those decisions affect whether we go to the left or go to the right, whether we choose one thing over another. But there are other decisions and there are other things that happen that are outside of our control. They're part of a much larger world of cause and effect. And as a result of that, we have to be prepared that at any time, our lives can come to a very different situation than what we find ourselves in now. And we have to ask ourselves, spiritually, am I ready for that? It may have an effect upon me, because it will change my life radically. But have I secured a steady place deep within my soul that is unaffected by the things that happen in this world? That come what may, I am the same. Ananda Moima, when she met Master, she said, "When I was born, I am the same. Before I was born, I am the same. As a young girl, I am the same. And even now, as the woman standing before you, I am the same." This sense of the eternal nature of your soul, God the Father within you, is something that most people do not know. And it is why there is, in many cases, so much suffering in this life, because things come and then we are happy. But then things are taken away. Health, vitality, life itself in this body suddenly is gone. And then where is our happiness? Where is our peace? Where is our stability? We feel like our entire world has been shaken and everything has been taken away from us. In one sense, as I went through this mystical crucifixion, just one thing after another, God took everything away from me. Now, in general, he kept my health, but even though the health was there, he would take away my life energy, and suddenly I felt tremendous life and light and power in God, but this body itself felt nothing. It felt like a rag doll, and it could just collapse to the ground right where it is, because everything was taken from it. And it forced me to confront the fact that at any moment, this life can be taken from this form. And what did that mean to me? Who was I if I was not this form? And of course, it helped to teach me, and it helped to purify my mind so that I came to know that I was more than this body. Now, we can say it, but until we have that experience, we don't always know how deeply attached we are to this body, to things remaining the same. When God took away home, and he took away profession, and he took away so many things, they felt like that they were things that I triangulated upon out in the world that helped me to know who I was. And when they were taken away, I no longer had these familiar markers. And it made me have to focus completely on God. God was the only thing that was a stable quotient in this life or beyond this life. And I thank God for every single thing that he took away from me, even though it wasn't easy at the time. And he even took away the notion that I was to be the good person, the good guy. There were things that I did that people were very unhappy about, that people really questioned whether that was the correct thing to do or not. And I had to go beyond what other people thought. I had to go even beyond what I thought. Now, that may sound like a strange thing to say, but it's true. Because I knew absolutely that this was what God was asking me to do. And yet, in my own mind, I judged it as not a right thing to do. And I even came to the point where God showed me that I would become seriously ill and then die if I didn't follow his direction. I said, so be it. And it was at that time that God intervened, and he said, no, that's an incorrect attitude. That is in as much as committing suicide, and it's not following my will. If it is my will, then ultimately it is correct. And you have to surrender to it. And I did, and it was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do. And yet, it was absolutely necessary that I do so. So this is not a path for the weak. It is not a path for those who are trying to escape from life. Sometimes people criticize those who lead a spiritual or religious life as trying to escape life. It's absolutely the opposite to that. You have to confront yourself. You have to confront everything about this life. You have to do it with truthfulness. You have to do it with honesty, not with a fantasy. But what you do is you do it with complete faith and trust in God. And that he will guide you. He will direct you. He will take you through everything that you need to go. Trust that your life is perfect even as it is now. And that when he gives you direction, trust that it is for the highest good. Now, how you know it's God's direction, that's something that comes with purity of mind. And you know it. You know it deep inside. You know that it's more than yourself, your own reasoning, your own desire nature. It's very different from that. But you have to test every spirit. You can't just go with every little whim and say that's God's will. It's an earned experience. And so you have to strive, you have to pray, you have to meditate, you have to do your spiritual work if you are to be certain that this is God's guidance. This is one of the great things that came forth in this book about Sarada Devi, is the purity of her soul. And that's a great hallmark in knowing any great saint or any realized being. It is that feeling of purity that you get. And you get it in spades in yourself when you get God contact. One time, Swami Vishwananda was talking about the Bhagavad Gita. And he said there are critics who say, well, how could this long conversation, 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, be going on in the midst of a battlefield? All these armies are arrayed. They're ready to go at each other tooth and nail. And here Krishna and Arjuna are carrying on this long conversation out in the midst of this field. And he had a very interesting answer to it, Swami Vishwananda. He says, it's like sitting in a completely darkened room. And suddenly somebody switches the light on. It may even be just for a flash. They flash lights on and off. In that flash, you see everything. And everything about that room is revealed to you. And if your mind is very receptive, you can even, when the lights are turned off, you can go through and you know everything, every piece of furniture, everything that is in that room. He said it is like that with Arjuna. He could have gotten that entire dialogue in a flash, just like that. All comes to him. All is perfect. All is revealed. So even though, like your life, the instance of Greg in this sense can change in a flash, just in a moment, and everything, all your plans, everything is completely out the window. So enlightenment can come just so, like a flash. And you know it. You know it all. Now, even though it apparently comes in a flash like that, it's the result of all the work, all the sadhana that you put in through time. So let us endeavor on. Let us seek out that purity. Let us seek out that pure realization in which we know that God is the sole actor, and yet we reside beyond all activity, that both are ours. And let us know that that perfect seed of God, that Christ, is embedded deep in us. And so it's not just a journey that you take alone, but that when your devotion, when your desire for God grows to such a degree, it activates that seed. And just like yeast that rises the bread, so does that begin to lift you up, to purify you. It makes you completely ready. So that when that day of realization comes to you, you may maintain it and hold it. You may make it your own. And yet, as Papa says, where is the sense of the I? Where is the sense of doer? It cannot be found. Because then there is only God. Only God. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Bliss. Amen. Pranams. I bow to the light within you.